Hello and welcome to the Tricorder Transmissions. I am Craig.
And I am Jeff.
And this week we are going to be talking about the third episode of the series, the original second pilot, Where No Man Has Gone Before. But before we get into the episode, man, has it been a newsworthy week for Star Trek.
Crazy.
Yeah.
You know, how a show the age of Star Trek, the original series, still winds up getting into the news in some way, shape, or form. So, interestingly enough, this past weekend, there's a show out there now that's really popular. I have a lot of friends that watch it. I must confess that I personally haven't watched many episodes. It's a show called Breaking Bad. It's on the AMC network.
AMC network, I believe. Yeah.
AMC, big time network nowadays. They have a lot of popular shows.
Yeah, that and The Walking Dead.
Yeah, well, you know, between the two, it's a powerhouse.
Their whole business model,
powerhouse.
Yeah.
So they have the show called Breaking Bad, which, you know, I won't give you too much of a rundown. It's about a teacher who has cancer and gets into selling. Creating and selling drugs to fund his rehabilitation. And at any rate, the episode that aired last weekend had a really funny Star Trek, the original series, reference in it. Two of the characters in the show were having a conversation. One of them has, in his own head, has written a Star Trek, the original series episode, which turns out to be really, really funny. it revolves around a dead time for the crew. Mm-hmm. They're kind of floating out there in space, bored with nothing mm-hmm. to do, right? And they put on a pie eating contest of all things. You know, silly as it sounds, he actually gets really deep into telling this story that he's come up with.
Yeah.
So it turns out to be, you know, the whole crew is involved at some point, and, you know, the replicator's churning out these pies and everyone's eating them, and they're slowly but surely everybody starts kind of bowing out. So it winds up being down to Kirk and Spock and Chekhov of all people, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kirk finally craps out.
He repeats, which is the competitive eating term for throwing up.
Throwing up, yeah. So he vomits, and so it's left down to Spock and Chekhov.
And Spock is the king of.
And Spock is the king of competitive eating, apparently, because of his Vulcan physiology. He's not susceptible to overstuffing as humans are. So, but one thing Spock does not know in this scenario is that Chekhov has worked out a deal with Mr. Scott. So Scotty is down in the transporter room and is actively beaming the pie that Chekhov ingests out of his body and into space. So Chekhov is effectively not eating anything at all. So he could eat this pie endlessly.
Oh, for days.
What a great idea,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
What a great idea. So it turns out, I guess, Scotty winds up getting distracted by Uhura.
Yeah.
Who walks in the room with her feminine wiles, and Scotty accidentally beams all of Chekhov's innards out into space. So that's doesn't seem like it would be an episode that would have made air, but it's a funny thought. And, you know, the reason why I was so fascinated with this was the guys who write this show, they have to have some affinity for Trek, because mm-hmm. Some of the things that they reference in this funny, bit about Star Trek, so it imparts to me that they have some knowledge of the show and some respect for the series. And one of the things they mention is that Chekhov has a bet riding on himself winning this contest, and the bet is in Quatluz, right? So we have a little reference to the Triskelion episode, which is really not that great of an episode, but that's the time they mention the currency Quatluz. There's also a part where they're talking about the pies that they're eating, and he says it's a certain type of berry that comes from the Delta Quadrant.
Yes.
And the other guy corrects him and says, "Dude, the Delta Quadrant's Voyager, man. Mm-hmm. You can't have Delta Quadrant berries in the original series." So he changes it to blueberries. But it's kind of funny knowing that I wonder how many of those jokes would those little subtleties would fall flat if you weren't a Star Trek fan. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't pick up on these things, but I immediately picked up on them. So and I showed this clip to Craig earlier, and did you get a kick out of it?
Oh yeah, totally. And actually, I've heard for a long time how great Breaking Bad is, and this might be the thing that pushes me over the edge to queue up my my Netflix this weekend and really maybe start digging through the early episodes. I know that they're in the second half of their final season now, so.
Well, I'll warn you now that I, from what I understand from people that I know who watch this show, it is ripe for binge watching.
Hey.
So be careful.
Hey, I'm actually pretty good. As Netflix has introduced their original programming, they did it with the show Lilyhammer, which had Steve Van Zandt. That show I treated like a regular TV show. I said, you know what? Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock is Lilyhammer night. So for the 6 or 7 weeks, I think that show ran 6 or 7 episodes, every Wednesday night at 8 o'clock, I sat down, turned on the TV, and treated it like it was airing. I did that with the new season of Arrested Development, which I'm still going through.
Good on you, man.
Orange is the New Black, I couldn't do that with.
Really?
That was a show that I blew through 13 episodes in a matter of days, and I felt bad.
I haven't even watched that yet.
Yeah, it's about a woman who goes to prison.
Yeah. It looks good. I've heard good things.
Yeah, it's really good, and I kind of regret not devoting like Thursday nights to it, but it was just so compelling that I just had a breeze right through it. But I will try and not be an addict, if you will, with Breaking Bad. And you know, maybe as the show
it's
progresses.
A hell of a commitment, man.
Yeah. Well, hey, I got time. Actually, not really, based on doing this the Star Trek podcast, which requires a lot of watching.
Yeah, and you have another podcast that you do too. Yeah. So, you know,
The Camel Clutch Cinema, which, if you're a fan of wrestling or movies that have wrestlers in them, would be right up your alley.
Yeah.
but speaking of movies, the last weekend in Las Vegas, there was the annual Star Trek convention, the big one. You know, they do a sort of a satellite version of this convention put together by the same people here in Jersey, which
we've
gone to. But this is the daddy of them all. This is the yearly one. You had William Shatner at this one. And apparently they took a fan poll and Into Darkness, the latest J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie, ranked number 13 out of 13 Star Trek movies.
And there are only 12 Star Trek movies.
Yes. Apparently, and I keep saying apparently, they included Galaxy Quest in this submission process,
you know,
or ranking process.
That, to me, that automatically disqualifies this poll. That's Galaxy Quest is hysterical. I love it. It's funny.
Yeah.
It's not a Star Trek movie. Yeah. How can you rank that against Star Trek movies when it's not a Star Trek movie?
Yeah.
That to me disqualifies the poll completely.
Yeah. But we can say, so in fairness, it ranked 12 out of 12. And I know when this news story hit, I sort of called you up and I said, hey, we got to talk about this, this Star Trek list. And it's interesting because not only are you ranking the movie against the other original series movies, you're ranking it against the Next Generation movies as well, which is kind of unfair. I think even ranking the two newer Star Trek movies against any of the other movies is unfair because as much as they take place in the same universe with you know, an alternate timeline or whatever, They are a different franchise.
They are.
But I do know that you rank this movie a lot higher than I do.
Yeah, I do.
And I maybe do. Maybe on the website we'll share our list of how we rank the Star Trek movies.
We're inviting criticism here.
But that's the great thing about anything that is subjective to your enjoyment of it. You know, I think it's, you know, unquestionable, really, that, you know, a lot of people are going to say, well, hands down, Wrath of Khan is the best Star Trek movie.
Rarely will I find a Star Trek fan who will deny that or will say that they don't think Wrath of Khan is the best Star Trek movie.
But, you know, there's got to be people out there that, you know, that Star Trek the Motion Picture is their favorite because that's probably the truest to the spirit of Star Trek, if you will. You know?
And I will say, unabashedly, as someone who likes The Final Frontier, that I take a lot of crap for liking that movie, and I do. I'll defend it, even though I know it's futile to do. I'll still defend it.
Yeah.
Resistance is futile, but I will defend it.
Well, I'm sure Shatner would love to hear that you defend that movie, because The Final Frontier was one of the ones that he directed, I believe.
Yep, yep.
You know, and that was when they were letting anybody direct. Nimoy directed part The Voyage Home.
Yeah.
He directed Search for Spock, I believe, too.
Yeah, yeah.
That was sort of how they got him back to play Spock. Yeah. Is, hey, let me direct it. And then I guess by part five, Shatner was like, hey,
I can
wait
do this too. Yeah, I can do this too.
Am I going to get to direct one?
Yeah, so, I guess at some point we'll have maybe we'll do a supplemental show sometime where we discuss, because if we're going to put our rankings out there in order, I would like the chance to defend myself. Because, you know, while we talked about this the other day,
yeah,
and while we agree on the first two and the last two in the list, everything between those is kind of mixed up in a way, you know. So I rank certain ones higher and you rank certain ones lower. So I would like, and I know that my list, I guarantee you, is going to draw some ire, because Star Trek V is not towards the bottom. So that in itself is going to gain me a lot of negative feedback.
Yeah, so maybe we will devote an episode, a supplemental log to that.
Yeah, sometime in the future.
Yeah, maybe sometime after we get through the original series.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this week we are talking about Where No Man Has Gone Before, and you have some of the air dates.
Yes, I do. So the original air date for this episode was September 22nd of 1966. Interestingly enough, it was the second pilot made, but it was not the first episode aired, which was an interesting choice, because airing it out of order like that kind of is and we talk about this, it's kind of jarring.
Uh-huh.
Right, for the fans. And the remaster came out on January 20th of 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So, and one more note that just came to me. This just came to my head, because we were talking about the Into Darkness being ranked at the bottom of the list. It's a really fortunate time that this came up, because during the period of time where fans were theorizing about who the villain in the movie would be, there was a lot of talk about the villain being Gary Mitchell, who is the villain in the episode we're about to watch.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's kind of timely that you know, Into Darkness came back up, just in time for us to talk about this.
Mm-hmm. And before we get started, I'll give a really quick synopsis. An encounter at the limits of our galaxy begins to change Lieutenant Commander Gary Mitchell and threatens the future of the Enterprise and the human race itself. So it sounds like we've got a pretty exciting episode in front of us, and I guess we'll start our countdown and get to it.
All right. So talk us through.
All right. So in 3, 2, 1. So it's the third episode that aired, but this is the second pilot that was filmed.
Yep.
After the cage was deemed too cerebral. They sort of regrouped and came back with a new cast for the most part, and a new pilot episode, Where No Man Has Gone Before. And there it is, the first time we are seeing Captain Kirk, played by William Shatner, and Leonard Nimoy as the returning Mr. Spock.
And we'll notice that Mr. Spock has some higher eyebrows in this one. They changed the way his eyebrows look to make him look a little less satanic.
Yeah, he's got kind of a yellow tint.
Yeah, and his makeup is a little bit different in this one too. They went with like a greenish yellow, and there's still a little bit of a smirk there on his face.
Yeah, the Spock character wasn't fully developed yet.
Yeah, you'll notice he's been changed quite a bit, but he's not quite fully baked. I mean, they kind of combined the number one from the original pilot with the Mr. Spock character to create one character. And he's not in his blue uniform yet either.
Yeah, they're using the recycled cage uniforms.
Yeah, but actually one of the one really important fact to note about this episode is that this is the first time you hear about one of Spock's parents being a human.
Yeah, well, he refers to it as an ancestor too.
Yeah.
They hadn't figured out that it was one of his parents. Or you could argue or take away from it that Spock didn't want to reveal
that one
of his parents was human.
Yeah, it's a historical sore spot for him. So look at Scotty in the background there.
And that's the first time we didn't see Scotty in the two previous episodes.
No, I don't believe he appears in those episodes. And Scotty, of course, is wearing the gold color, too. He's not in his red uniform here, either.
Yeah. I mean, this whole episode, I'd imagine, was kind of weird for viewers. So this is the third week the show was on the air in 1966.
Yep.
And, you know, you sit down on, what, Friday night to watch it. I think it was Friday nights.
Yep.
And you've watched 2 weeks worth. And then this third week, you get kind of a different episode.
Yeah, you do. But this episode is significant in a couple of different ways. And something that was mentioned on one of our previous episodes that we thought was correct is that apparently was not correct. Out of all of the Star Trek episodes in this particular series, this episode has the highest body count.
Really?
This has a 12-man body count.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So,
Are we counting the people that they find on the planet?
No. You're counting the people from the other ship, the nine that's.
Oh.
Well, not the other ship that when the energy storm hits, there's nine people on the Enterprise that die.
Okay.
And Spock says nine people died.
Yeah.
And you get three other deaths, which I won't spoil in case anybody's watching this for the first time.
Yeah, and I actually just got some of my episodes confused. I watched a bunch of episodes this week.
All right.
Trying to play catch up for the show. So forgive me there.
No problem.
So here's Gary Mitchell.
Yep.
Who we learn has a long history with Kirk. 15-year history. They were in, what I guess, Starfleet together.
Yep. And they're pretty good friends at this point. So, and you know, and Kirk's making a couple jokes here, you know, kind of like a little neck cutting joke here. And he's still a little more jovial than he winds up being in the rest of the series. And here we see Kirk has another female yeoman. So, which is kind of different because you've seen in the first two episodes that aired, he had Janice Rand. Yeah. And in this one. So, yeah, I guess if you were watching this originally in 66 when it aired, it would be kind of confusing because you wouldn't really know exactly what was going on here, why certain characters were who they were, why the uniforms had changed.
Yeah. McCoy disappears. He's replaced by two doctors on this episode. I mean, it's almost amazing that they aired this at all. I'd imagine they said, hey, well, we spent the money to produce the episode. You're damn sure we're going to air it. I'm surprised Roddenberry didn't have, you know, more, you know, problems with the order that they broadcast things in. But for me, I mean, it really, and here's the two doctors with Sulu there, who isn't really established as the helmsman yet.
No, and Scotty, who's not really established well either. And we have another guest star here.
Yeah, Sally Kellerman of Hidden Valley Ranch
and Back to School. Back to school. Little did she know she'd go on to be Rodney Dangerfield's straight man in a funny, very funny comedy movie later on in life.
Oh, one of Rodney's best.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Sally Kellerman's character, she is playing a doctor, Dr. Elizabeth Danner.
Yes.
And then the gentleman between Scotty and Sulu looking very pensive, is the doctor for this episode, I guess.
And notice how he's still kind of elderly and grumpy looking.
Yeah.
They had that part of the character down.
Yeah. He almost looks like Philip Baker Hall. He was the book detective on Seinfeld.
Oh, wow.
And also he was in Boogie Nights.
Wow. Wow. One thing you'll notice about this episode, one of the reasons that I actually really like this episode, is Spock speaks very loudly throughout this episode.
Yeah,
it's like they cranked up Spock's volume.
It's very almost intense. Especially when he's giving, relaying information during, you know, maneuvers.
The energy storm and
it is interesting. Watching Spock's sort of progression is pretty interesting because I think where. Probably an episode away from getting the Spock that we know and love.
You know, another fun fact about this episode is it really focuses a lot on ESP.
Yes.
You don't hear about ESP any at all in the series no. after this. You do hear about telepaths
yeah.
and empaths, but they don't mention ESP.
Yeah, I'd imagine maybe ESP in 66 yeah. or, you know, the mid-60s was just starting to sort yeah. of, like, catch on as, like, you know...
That's what I was thinking.
A buzzword.
It might have been a hot-button topic back then. And that's one great thing about this entire series is that when you're watching this, you see things that were important at the time that the series was being written.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the characters that they reference or urban legends or legends and heroes of the past that they mentioned meant a lot more back then they do to some people now. I mean,
oh, yeah.
when people, younger people would watch this now, they might be awful confused as to where all these characters they were talking about came from.
Mm-hmm. So now we're getting word that the ship that sent the distress call, the SS Valiant, was destroyed.
Yep.
Which is kind of, you know, reminiscent of the Cage. The Cage in this episode sort of have, you know,
yeah.
if you read the plot synopsis, it's, you know, at the very beginning, it's very similar. You know, answering a long-lost distress call, and then something happens.
You know, there are so many episodes in this series that start out with distress calls. Mm-hmm. They're always answering a distress call from somewhere or something, and it winds up getting them in trouble. I like how they have the fast food ordering little yeah. microphones there on the little the yeah. metal arms.
And that'll be the last time we see that as well.
Yeah.
That's the only time it made an appearance in the series.
Sensor beam on. Yeah.
You know, not counting the cage or I guess any of the footage we see in the menagerie. I don't even know how much of the bridge we see in the menagerie.
So here we have this ion storm, and Spock speaking extremely loudly, yes. which is really contrary to his character.
Yeah. And I just love how, you know, you sort of had this group of people on the bridge observing. You know, you've got Sulu, who up until this point has... You know, just sort of held his hand on his chin. I guess he didn't have much else to do.
Yeah, and you know, they're bracing to go into this energy storm, and there's people just standing there. You know, you would think that they would either sit down or otherwise brace themselves for what could be some very rough space ahead.
Yeah.
But no. No, they don't.
Well, and that always seemed to sort of be an issue with Star Trek is... The bridge wasn't really designed for any kind of, you know...
No, not at all. You know? It wasn't really conducive to having extra non-essential personnel. Sure. So there was no gallery seating.
And the bridge takes some severe damage here.
It definitely does.
And they're putting the ship on manual.
So any minute now, we're going to see a couple of people here get zapped.
Yeah.
By some lightning, and apparently the lightning only targets those who have ESP.
Boom!
Some reason or another. So Sally Kellerman gets zapped first, and there is Gary Mitchell getting zapped and going down. Lateral power. So here comes Spock to help out. So, any interesting facts you got there for us?
Well, we can talk, I guess, while we have a little bit of action going on. We can talk about the creative people behind the scenes here.
Sure.
The episode was written by Samuel Peeples, who died in 1997.
Yeah.
His career started actually writing Western novels.
Hmm.
And one interesting Star Trek-related fact is he also wrote the first episode of the animated series.
Very cool.
So that's pretty neat. And he also wrote episodes of The Rifleman and Bonanza.
Hmm.
And then the episode was directed by James Goldstone, who died in 99. And he also, around that time, directed two episodes of The Outer Limits.
Oh.
So, and now we've got Gary is going to have a very, very cool reveal here when he wakes up.
Yeah, you're going to see some very interesting... For the time.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really interesting point about those contact lenses that they were wearing.
They look like they hurt like hell.
They were actually what they call scleral lenses.
So, yeah. It was.
So, they were custom-made scleral lenses, which were very painful. But Sally Kellerman didn't have a problem with them. She was used to contacts already, so they didn't bother her. But Lockwood could barely tolerate them, and the only way he could see through them was by holding his head in a slightly upper angle and looking down.
So that almost like sort of dictated his performance.
And it actually enhanced his performance.
Yeah. That's kind of neat.
To making him look more aloof and superior.
There's a lot of times during this episode where you look like his eye looks irritated. I mean, there's no other way to do that back then except for...
And now we're seeing some ESP notes.
Yes.
The Esper-oriented abilities. We're seeing some notes in the crewman's log here. So we're seeing a connection between the SS Valiant and their ESP searching of their records and the crew members who were hit by the lightning. And Spock has figured it out, as usual. So she has a high degree of ESP.
Yeah, we're going to get a little talk of ESP. And it seems like there is a little bit of a sort of ESP prejudice.
I'm detecting it as well.
So, you know, I guess they're trying to make us sympathetic to the Esper's plight.
Yeah, and Spock is pointing out the dangerous parts of these ESP. So it's almost like you've got these X-Men types.
Yeah, yeah. Spock even mentioned setting stuff on fire. You know, he almost, you know, was making warnings about that Stephen King novel, Firestarter.
Firestarter, yeah.
Or even Carrie. Although I guess Carrie was more of a...
So here you get a really good shot of those contact lenses, the silver reflective contact lenses.
He's absorbing... information from the ship's records. And let's talk a little bit about Gary Lockwood.
Okay.
I think is probably, aside from this episode, he's most famous for playing Frank Poole in 2001 A Space Odyssey, which come out a couple years later. And between 1959 and 2004, he appeared in 40 theatrical and made-for-TV features. And get this.
Jeez.
80 TV show episodes, including Murder, She Wrote, Simon and Simon, Trapper John M.D., and T.J. Hooker with William Shatner.
Wow. They go full circle, man. You wrap right back around.
Yeah. So he had quite a career. You know, he's been relatively quiet since 2004.
Yeah. So here we're getting a little bit of a demonstration of Kirk's concern for Mitchell.
And Mitchell is indicating that he feels better than he has in his entire life.
We're getting into the thematic part of this episode where Star Trek is pretty famous. At least this Star Trek series is very famous for tackling themes or you know, approaching specific stories. And the story that we're seeing in this episode, of course, is seemingly normal people gaining godlike superpowers, right? We've seen this before in other venues. It's been done tons and tons of times. We've seen this... done in different shows and movies, but in this respect, we're seeing it done in it with a Star Trek spin on it. So what we've seen so far is an energy storm in space, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So as other superheroes have been created in the past, or supervillains, as the case may be,
it's almost like something out of a Marvel comic book.
Right. So they get shocked by this lightning, this space lightning.
Yeah, it's almost a Fantastic Four.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So. Now he hasn't really started to realize any of his power. They seem to develop rather slowly at first. But the thing that I think is cool about this episode is that it's not just one person that gains powers. It's two.
Yeah.
And you get to see them both developing at slightly different times, but you can see how one goes in one direction.
Sure.
And the other one chooses to remain as a good guy, if you will.
Yeah, it's a morality play, sort of, you know.
Yeah.
It shows how the effects of that, you know, it shows that the power doesn't immediately corrupt.
And, you know, they're from two different walks of life, of course. One's a doctor, and the other is essentially a soldier, military person, you know, a space explorer.
And there he is absorbing some text again, and... We learn through Spock that he is actually, with every flicker, he's reading. He's taking in that information, and there they are, sort of spying on him.
Yeah, a little interesting layover there with the images of the text that he's taking in.
Spock is saying that this Gary Mitchell is the Gary Mitchell you knew is pretty much gone. he's developing powers at an alarming rate. Mm-hmm. The increase in speed that he's reading, and Spock basically pontificates that.
And here Gary knows they're watching him.
Very creepy. Basically pontificates that, you know, within a matter of days or hours or weeks, Gary is going to be and there's our medical.
If you notice, I get a good glance there at that medical panel up top, and two of the columns say blood underneath them.
Yeah, I know. I think one says temperature too.
Mm.
We'll see it in another episode where we get a pretty good close up of it.
So he has nothing plugged into him. So I guess we can assume that it works without being attached to you in any way.
Yeah,
you don't have to have any, you know, needles or probes stuck on you or in you.
Yeah, there must be either sensors in the bed. Or just maybe in that general area, or it interfaces with whatever little dongle the doctor's holding, you know.
Yep.
What was that little thing that comes off the tricorder that sort of...
what's the name of that thing? It's the little thing that looks like a little capsule.
Yeah, I think there's probably many a Star Trek fan yelling at their listening device right now.
Lungs, brain, temp. That's some of the other ones there.
And it's interesting because sickbay pretty much has the look of a 1960s hospital.
It kind of does.
Which will change as the series progresses.
Now, another interesting thing about this is, so the lightning storm affects people who have ESP and grants them some other power. So the powers that they seem to be granted go well beyond what normally is expected of people with ESP, you know, the powers that people get. You know, you think they have telepathic powers where they can, they can, you know, read your mind, or they can put images into your mind. They can sense things that are coming, or quote unquote start fires.
Yeah, or flatline yourself.
So what we found is that Gary can, control his own metabolism. He can make himself appear dead, and he can also manipulate the computer systems and cause the gauges to go up and down. So he's developing the ability to control electronic equipment as well.
Yeah.
So we're graduating beyond what normal ESP is. Later on, he'll develop even further powers that go beyond.
Yeah, and I think right now he's at a minus the eyes. He's at a pretty cool point. I mean, I'd like to be able to sit here on the couch and sort of raise and lower the volume with thought, change the channel with the blink of an eye, you know, have a glass of water brought into me from the other room.
Pretty soon, if you get yourself one of those newfangled game boxes that are coming out in the near future, they have that. You can just kind of speak into the air, and it controls your television for you. So he won't bring you a glass of water, but now she's asking him to recall a page out of a book to test his new memory power. So apparently the energy storm has also granted him superhuman photographic memory.
Yeah.
Written by Tarbold
in 1996. And he points out it's interesting that she picked that line because it's considered one of the most romantic couplets from the 90s, a sonnet of the past couple centuries. So apparently, poetry in the mid to late 90s sort of saw a resurgence.
Funny that didn't happen in our version of the 90s.
Yeah, instead we got
boy bands.
And Pearl Jam.
Boy bands and Pearl Jam. So. Well, I guess you could say Pearl Jam had some good songwriting abilities, but yeah. I don't know about the boy bands. So here we have another poor unfortunate that's not going to make it through the episode coming in.
Yeah, and he's got like that, what's that actor? Goodness. All the girls love him. He was in Drive and... Ryan Gosling. He's kind of got like a Ryan Gosling look, doesn't he?
Yeah.
If they ever remade this episode as a movie. So now Gary is warning him about checking a part on the ship that if it goes unchecked will basically destroy the ship.
Yep. Yep, it's got damaged, and so this gives us the idea that he can sense things mm-hmm. that are well beyond his local area. So he's sensing problems with ship's equipment, and he gets pretty much dismissed a little bit there.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, he hasn't. Yeah, he's remarking that they haven't noticed it. He's kind of looking up in the air and seeing things. And
yeah, it almost seems like he's starting to feel pity for people that they're, you know.
And he's saying that he saw the image in Kelso's mind mm-hmm. of the part.
So yeah, and here we are. We see the burned out part. Kind of looks like a shock absorber.
Yeah, and Dr. Daner has come in, yeah. Talk a little bit about Gary, and Spock is again expressing his concern about what Gary's turning into. He seems to have quite a bit of insight into this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she was expressing a sort of concern about Spock's ability to sort of let his emotions show based on the fact that him and Kirk... Neither one is really able to sort of step back and look at the situation from a sort of a human perspective and say, hey, this is Gary. This is, you know, a colleague, a guy that we've worked with for a long time.
Yeah, you know, and this is another one of those situations where the Spock character in this pilot is only partially baked, because if this had happened further along in the series, I would think that Spock would want to study what was happening to Gary and not, you know, immediately jump to either getting rid of him or trying to put him away or solve a problem mm-hmm. here, because he's seeing a future problem developing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now they're coming up with the.
And we've again got Scotty and Sulu and the doctor sort of just observing again, you know.
Yeah, and she's insisting that he's turning into a better, more advanced human being mm-hmm. with a higher power. I wonder if at this point she realizes that it might be happening to her as well, because she didn't react to the lightning as quickly as Gary Mitchell did, although she will later.
Yeah. So here's Sulu now laying down for us. The mathematics of the increased acceleration of Mitchell's powers.
And Spock is warning that very soon he's going to grow in power so much that humans are going to be nothing but an annoyance to him. Spock has an alarming amount of insight into this. So Nomus Kirk is dismissing everybody. He's done with the conversation. So it begs the question, though, what would all of them do if they had been endowed with these powers? You know, Spock already developed some interesting abilities later on in the series, nothing quite to this extent, mm-hmm. but he does develop some interesting abilities as his character gets written and more fleshed out. But what would Kirk have done mm-hmm. if he was one of the ones that got hit with the lightning and developed these powers?
Yeah, I think either way, you can't function as a working member of society anymore, regardless of how you use your powers, either for good or for bad. I mean, I just think, at least within the confines of this show, you would have to be left on a deserted planet to sort of amuse yourself.
So here's another, this is another deviation from what Spock, I think, would normally have done. He's suggesting that Kirk either strand Mitchell on a planet or kill him outright.
Uh-huh.
That is, that's really kind of over the edge for Spock's character.
Yeah.
I think he would have to get pushed really, really far in order to come to that conclusion mm-hmm. normally. You know, we've seen, as we will see in many other episodes, there are situations where Spock could have easily remedied a situation by killing someone, but he opts not to do it. For whatever reason, so...
Well, logically.
Yeah.
Spock will take everything to its logical conclusion and then decide whether it's worth doing. And Spock, you know, warned him interestingly here that, you know, Kirk's got to make a decision, but at the same time, the captain of the Valiant waited too long to make his decision, and it cost everyone their lives.
Yeah. I can't help but wonder if this situation might have been another one of those times where if it was approached a different way by Kirk and Spock, if they could have influenced the way that Mitchell developed. Because it seems that Mitchell is developing this way because he senses people are getting scared of him or spying on him. And I would imagine it would start to really annoy him. Probably would annoy me too. You know, if my friends, people who I've been, you know, in space with for years, or people I've been in the academy with for years, all of a sudden started to doubt me.
And that's a great effect there.
It was very cool. And now he's also developed telekinetic powers.
I'd also imagine, though, that as his powers develop, he's losing more and more of his personality.
Maybe.
I think he's relating less and less to the human side of himself.
That's quite possible, but I don't think that would necessarily be the case with every person, you know, this would happen to. I think it really it depends on you at your base. I think it speaks a lot about somebody to see some develop this way, what kind of person he was on the inside. You know, as he develops these kinds of powers, I think if you were inherently a good person and you develop these powers, you would start to think of ways that you could help people instead of thinking of, you know, how you can, you know, flick people off like insects and here's Gary telling him he should kill him while he can.
Yes.
And look at the phaser that Spock has on his belt.
Yeah. And boom.
And we have lightning capabilities. So Gary can now defend himself with force lightning.
Yeah. I think the other interesting thing to talk about, though, is the real implications of somebody like this existing in any kind of modern society, be it ours or the future that is Star Trek. And if it's even feasible, how people would react. It would have people questioning a lot of things that they believe. Yeah. And I'm sure there are people out there that would be ready to worship him as a god.
I wouldn't doubt it.
And then how do you respond there?
I wouldn't doubt it. Well, I think that at least people in an authoritative position would probably react just like Kirk and Spock are reacting with, you know, fear and distrust. See, and now he's exhibiting, he's getting angry and he's, you know, ready to use his powers for what we would consider evil.
And he's stunned just enough to just sort of be hunched over there so they can transport down to the planet. And before we continue this discussion, here we see a wonderful matte painting. And the matte painter for this was Albert Whitlock, who was considered one of the best matte painters of all time. Around this time, he also worked on Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. He would go on to work on The Sting. And he won two Academy Awards for his work, one on Earthquake, the Charlton Heston movie, and then another one on The Hindenburg. So the matte painting is kind of, you know, an old Hollywood staple. You know, it's mostly been replaced now by working computers. But that was an Albert Whitlock painting that was incorporated into a live-action shot. Very nice. Cool.
Very cool tidbit there. So now we see they have beamed down to the planet, and they are in a little facility here.
Yeah, and they're looking to repair some of the damage that that hit some of the components of the ship.
Yeah, and they've also locked Gary up behind a force field. Yeah. So there must be a brig down here in this facility that they've beamed down to. So now you can see, you can really see why, you know, Gary is getting increasingly upset with them, because now they've locked them away again. You know, I think it's proof positive to Gary that they don't intend to take him back with them. They're going to leave him there. You know, and now he's
pleading
this
to him
is
as
it.
A friend.
This is it. Now he's realizing that, you know, Kirk isn't the man that he thought he was, or he feels that Kirk has turned on him.
Yeah, and he's basically telling the equivalent of a story. Hey, I took a bullet for you, you know.
And he's asking Kirk why he's afraid of him.
Yeah.
You know, he's asking Kirk why he's afraid of him. And I think he's got a valid point here.
And yeah. Kirk's giving it back to him, you know. You know, it's you know, it's kind of a cool character moment for Kirk. You know, it shows that, you know, he's not going to let, you know, Gary sort of paint him into this, you know, version of how he wants Kirk to feel about himself.
And now Gary is telling Kirk that he should kill him as Spock wants him to. He's telling him he's a fool if he doesn't kill him. Yeah. Gary's not yet powerful enough, and yeah, he's boom. Temporarily lost his power. The force field apparently drained a little of his strength, but up, it comes right back again. So we see that it is possible to weaken him, which is a pretty important point.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not completely indestructible.
And there he is doing that yeah, you definitely notice the head tilted back.
Yeah, and imagine how, you know, he had to wear those things for
hours
and hours and hours. And, you know, as somebody who just recently started wearing contact lenses, I can tell you, you know, if you're not used to putting things in your eyes, that can definitely cause you some serious discomfort. So I got to give the guy some props for being able to remain professional and pull us off.
Mm-hmm. So there's Scotty replacing some of the damaged bridge equipment, and he he's kind of turned around and gave this look like, hey, what a boss am I, man? You know, it was just a real cool look, like Scotty saying, yeah, that's what I do.
Yeah, and Scotty, and you know, it's just a foreshadowing of all of the engineering heroics that we'll be seeing from Mr. Scott over the years. He really comes through. And Kirk is still conflicted about leaving Gary there or killing him. And Spock is talking about his logical outlook on things. And there's an interesting phaser rifle that Spock is carrying that I don't think we ever see again after this episode.
That was another holdover from the pilot. And interestingly enough, I actually have it's buried in my closet at this point, but I have a poster.
Really?
A Jim Kirk
really?
Poster.
Where he's got the phaser
where
rifle?
Where he's basically holding that phaser rifle.
Yeah, I had read that they did some promotional materials where that phaser rifle appears. Mm-hmm. Yep. So we see that Kelso is going to be getting a commendation here. And some of the landing parties going back up.
Yeah, it'll basically be Kirk, Mitchell, and the Doctor staying behind,
and Spock, yellow Spock.
Yeah. It's...
And Gary seems to be kind of lost in thought there. And Kelso will be on the, and they're going to blow Gary up, I guess, and he knows it. And Dana is staying behind.
Yeah. Got a weird kind of fade there. And we see that this is occurring at the same moment.
Yep. Yeah, he's got the telekinetic powers, and here
boom,
is...
Boom, you've talked too long. It's like being pulled off stage, but instead he is getting choked out.
And here's our first on-camera death of this episode. So that's 10. 10, 10 down. So there'll be two more. Who will they be? We're still arguing over whether or not...
here he is again.
He should have killed him.
He should have killed me. It's almost becoming like a taunt.
Yeah. Well, he's got a point.
Well, but at this point, too, he knows. Boom, and there we go. Some more shots.
And, you know, he knows that Sally Kellerman's on his side. So, of course... not going to give her the force lightning.
Yeah, and then we're going to get a reveal here.
Yeah, I wonder if he knew all along that she was going to change into what she's just changed into.
And there they are, admiring themselves in the mirror.
And that aloof look on Gary Mitchell's face.
So now you basically have two gods.
Yeah. So, and here's where we'll start to see how they develop in different ways. Mm-hmm. You know, she seems to retain more of her human side than Mitchell does.
Mm-hmm. We learn, Captain's just learning that Kelso is dead. And Spock is alive. Spock is alive.
Thankfully.
Then, yeah.
Don't give him a pill.
Kirk does not want Spock to go along.
No. And it's interesting that in the pilot here that the doctor is giving them pills.
Yeah, which...
you don't really see that much.
Yeah, that would almost seem like later in the series that would be something that McCoy would consider barbaric.
Yeah, shoving a pill down your throat, exactly. Everything's done by hypo spray after this.
And now so. Kirk is giving a famous captain-like order. If you don't hear from me in X amount of time, leave.
Yep. Yep, that'll become a theme later on, too.
And he's not saying only leave. He's also saying destroy this planet.
Yep.
Or destroy this section of the planet.
Yep. So they're going to go off here, and they're going to kind of have some discussions on what they think they should do and...
Now, it's kind of interesting because technically, Kirk could have just beamed up with the Doctor and Spock and they could have hightailed it out of there. But instead, Kirk is basically saying, hey, this is a mess that I have to clean up because God forbid, God being a funny word to use, God forbid somebody comes along and stumbles upon these two.
Right, right. And here we just saw Gary's developed yet another power.
Yeah, he can some kick-ass.
He can manifest things out of nothing. He can either change matter into other matter or generate life where there wasn't any. So he's almost like a Genesis project in himself, right?
Yes.
So they're exploring this new oasis that Gary just waved his hand and created.
Yeah, he really admires his handiwork. And there he is drinking some of that fresh water.
He made a very strange-looking grape bush that's apparently... spawning some white grapes,
and he's telling the doctor that she'll get to where he is.
Yeah, she'll catch up slowly. It took her a while. And Kirk is sneaking up on them with this awesome looking contraption of a phaser rifle.
For a society that wasn't really war based, that's a very warlike looking weapon.
Yeah, they have an awful lot of weapons.
And now Mitchell's pretty much keyed into the fact that Kirk has come looking for him.
And he's given away his position.
Yeah.
So, seeing the powers that Gary has developed, if you could pick one of those powers to have, which one would you take?
I gotta say, the ability to create things out of thin air...
That's pretty damn cool.
That is. I mean, again, with the analogy of sitting here on my couch, you know, if all of a sudden I decided I want a plate of meatloaf and mashed potatoes, boom, there it is.
Boom, there. All you do is think about it.
Yeah.
And wave your hand. Interesting.
Yeah. I
might have to go with that one. That's a pretty good one. Probably the most useful, as long as it wasn't a limited, you could just create anything you wanted to. Mm-hmm. That would pretty much take care of about everything.
Yeah, I mean, the only drawback is you'd probably realistically never need to leave the house.
Maybe not a bad thing. Not in this day and age, anyway. And now Gary can sense Kirk coming from a mile away.
And now the doctor's got the power. She can see him as well.
And, you know, with the power that Gary has, he makes some weird-looking fruit. I don't know what that stuff's supposed to be, but it does not look appetizing in the least. Yeah.
And Gary's basically now trying to pull her over to the dark side. He's saying, I want you to see what this power can do. And he almost wants it to corrupt her the way it sort of corrupted him.
Yeah.
And she's sort of playing into it right now. I think she's kind of, you know, in that you know, that moment where you're sort of drunk with you know, and I think anytime you have any kind of power, you know, there's that initial moment where you're sort of drunk with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So, you know, she's still trying to make up her mind, I think, where she's going to go with this. And I think she needs a demonstration of the extreme evil use of this power to really drive home that she shouldn't mm-hmm. take that type of an advantage of these gifts. Mm-hmm.
See, and there's Kirk making the argument that the Doctor was saying, soon we'll be able to sort of evolve in a way that would have taken man millions of years. And Kirk says, that's all well and good, but what's Gary going to do with his power? Which is the big problem. And Kirk gives a possibly one of the best acting performances of the series here, where he's pleading with the Doctor about various things. And
he's given many impassioned speeches mm-hmm. before, but this one is very good. He's really trying to appeal to her sense of her sense of humanity, her the Doctor part of her, who's compassionate and kind and wants to help people. Mm-hmm. And she's warned him that Gary is on his way.
Nice little roll there. And boom. The phaser rifle has no effect.
And he's developed yet another power. He is pretty much completely indestructible at this point.
Yeah.
And he flicks the phaser rifle away.
And he... yeah. And he's basically he's letting it be known that he is gonna kill Kirk.
And he's trying to figure out the best way to do it. And he's talking about how he's gonna bury Kirk, and he's got a grave dug right there. How convenient.
It would be more convenient if there was a tombstone, and boom.
And there it is.
There we go. With star dates.
Yes, and it says James R. Kirk on it, by the way.
Oh, yes.
If you happen to notice.
Yeah, this we would not learn his middle name until what? The animated series?
And it's also his middle initials actually starts with a T, not an R.
Uh-huh.
There are a couple of explanations given later for why there was an R there. One was it was a nickname that Gary had for him, Rhinoceros. You know, it was a pilot, so we can forgive.
Mm-hmm. You can almost also say that probably back in 66, with TV technology the way it was, a lot of people probably weren't even able to make out what was written on that tombstone.
Yeah, you know, I had read that when I was reading into the remastered editions. One of the things that I read that was very interesting, that when these shows were originally broadcast, a lot of them were broadcast, you know, from tape copies that were sent to different affiliate stations and over, you know, questionable strength airwaves. So what you really saw on your TV looked nothing mm-hmm. like what we're seeing mm-hmm. now.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting thing about a lot of stuff that was shot on film in the 60s that gets restored. You know, people don't understand that, you know, they were working with technology that was very, very good. And it's just a matter of it needed to sort of be, you know, taken to the level of, you know, of how good it could look. And here we have the two gods fighting.
Shooting lightning bolts at each other.
Yeah. The Doctor basically realized that Gary cannot move forward the way he is.
Yeah, she saw how he was torturing Kirk and realized that he's kind of grown too powerful and too evil with his powers. And
yeah, and there he's lost his powers momentarily, and the Doctor's warning Kirk that he doesn't have a lot of time. So we're going to see a double axe handle pretty soon, which is one of our favorite moves in Star Trek. And boom, there it is. And we got a nice stunt performer there.
And while we're watching the fight scene, it's a good thing to mention that this scene, from what I understand, was the scene that sold the series to the network.
Sure. Well, it's got the action they were looking for.
They were looking for the action, and Kirk delivers. It's one of Kirk's finer fight scenes.
Yeah, and his shirt's already ripped. You know, this is...
some seriously good fisticuffs going on here. And this doesn't look... nearly as choreographed and Up, oh, too late.
Yeah.
And Gary's power comes back. Yep. So much for that. Yep. I don't think Kirk has much of a chance at this point.
No, it's almost time to fall in the grave and roll credits, and it was a good series while it lasted.
We made it one whole episode. Oh,
yeah.
That was a nice flip move, too, there.
Yeah.
Yep, Gary.
Up, and now
into the grave
the
they go.
And Kirk definitely jumps out, and here we go.
He's going to grab the phaser rifle.
Boom. Buried alive.
Oh, and the tombstone fell on top of him first.
It looks like it hit him in the bread basket too.
Ouch, man. That was good thinking by Kirk. He didn't try to shoot Gary. He immediately went for the rocks to fall on Gary. So, Kirk's got some fighting chops.
Yeah, he had telegraphed that.
Yeah, he can think on his feet.
Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting thing there is the fact that was enough to sort of do Gary in.
Yeah, well, I guess he wasn't completely indestructible. He can't, you know, the energy rifle can't hurt him.
Yeah.
The Sally Kellerman's power could hurt him, but I think he wasn't immune to physical damage.
Yeah, especially from behind, I guess. Yeah,
the crushing power of those heavy rocks.
Yeah, and so we've lost the doctor.
It didn't take much to kill her off.
Well, no, she took quite a few shots from Gary, though, you know, and there, Kirk's gonna beam up. As the episode's winding down, let's talk about the essential or non-essential nature of this episode, the first pilot, Where No Man Has Gone Before.
You go first.
All right. I'm going to say that in spite of a lot of the things we see here that might be sort of cool character moments, I don't think there's anything essential in terms of character history that makes this an essential episode. And I would almost argue that the sort of use of stuff that's left over from the original pilot causes more confusion than anything else. And I think as cool as this episode can be, I would not consider this an essential watch. I mean, historically, of course, it's the second pilot, so it's hard to say, but I think if you really look at it, between the differences in Spock and the differences in the look of the show itself, it's a non-essential episode.
Well, I'm gonna disagree with you on this, and I do consider this an essential episode, mostly from a historical standpoint. I think it's really cool. I like the storyline, but I think it's really cool to see the introduction of Kirk as a captain and see how much of him really held over, and to see the development of Spock into what he was or what they thought he was going to be and how he got from one place to another in his character development. I think it's great from a guest star point of view. Mm-hmm. I think it's really cool to see some people who you may see in other shows on this episode and see how they worked with the Star Trek cast and with the story. I think we disagree, but with good reasons on both sides. I can definitely see your point of view on this.
Mm-hmm.
From a series point of view, you could probably get a lot of this information or all of this information about the characters other places. But I think most of my reason for saying that I think this is essential is from a historical standpoint. I think it's cool as a pilot. I think it's the episode that sold the show. So I think from that point of view, it's really worth watching. Just to see, especially that last fight scene, is probably one of the better fight scenes in all of Star Trek, in my opinion.
Yeah, sure. Fair enough. So that brings us to the end of this episode. And as always, we'd like to thank you for sitting down and watching Star Trek with us. And we will see you next episode.
Thanks a lot, guys. Take it easy.
I ever tell you about my Star Trek script?
Star Trek script?
Yeah, I gotta write it down is all. The Enterprise is 5 parsecs out of Rigel 12. Nothing's going on, neutral zone is quiet, the crew is bored, so they put on a pie-eating contest. The whole crew's in the galley, they're eating Tullaberry pies.
Tullaberry?
Tullaberries. from Gamma Quadrant, yo.
That's Voyager, dude.
Okay, blueberries then. They're eating blueberry pies
better.
As fast as the replicator can churn them out. Blitz, blitz. Finally, it's down to just three. Kirk, Spock, and Chekhov. Okay, Spock always wins these things.
How is Spock gonna beat Kirk, yo? Spock's like a toothbrush. Look at Kirk, he's got room to spare.
Spock has total Vulcan control over his digestion. You wanna hear this or not?
Yeah, go.
Okay, finally, Kirk, he can't take it anymore. He yorks. Now it's just down to Chekhov and Spock. But Chekhov, you see, he's got a whole fat stack of Quaaludes riding on this. And he has figured out a way to win. He's got Scotty back in the transporter room, locked in on Chekhov's stomach. Every time Chekhov eats a pie, Scotty beams it right out of him.
Where's he sending him? The toilet?
Space. Oh. There's blueberries just floating out there, frozen because it's in space. And Chekhov is just shoveling them into his mouth. And Spock's like, I can't believe this Russian is defeating me. Meanwhile, Scotty's in the transporter room fiddling with levers when Lieutenant Uhura comes in and she's got, you know, her big pointies and Scotty's fingers are all sweaty.
No.
Chekhov screams. He sprays blood out of his mouth.
Oh.
Scotty beamed his guts into space.
No way.